This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, weathering the economic downturn. John Wagoner covers the personal finance beat for USA Today. He's our guest this afternoon. He's with us to talk about the credit crisis and how we got here, as well as what we might do to get through these times, protect our savings and investments, and keep the goals we have for our money on track. John Wagoner's latest book is an examination of what happened to Bear Stearns and the response of the Federal Reserve. The title, Bailout, What the Rescue of Bear Stearns and the Credit Crisis Mean for Your Investments. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments. You can join our discussion this afternoon with a telephone call. The number's in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. John Wagoner has worked for USA Today since 1989, covering mutual funds, stocks, bonds, and the economy. He also writes a column called Investing for the paper. He's a regular contributor to the PBS program, the Nightly Business Report. He's also one of the authors of the NOLO Guide, The Busy Family's Guide to Money. John Wagoner's new book, Bailout, is published by Wiley. Again, the phone numbers, 333-9455, that's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. John Wagoner, good to talk with you again today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. It's a real pleasure.
There appears today that there will be a shift in the target of the government's $700 billion bailout plan to be continued, the purchase of stock in banks. That part of the plan is aimed at apparently at encouraging banks to lend money. But today, the Treasury Secretary spoke of widening the program to assist non-bank financial institutions and move away from purchasing troubled assets. That's a whole lot of stuff. And I'm not quite sure how we sort that out, those of us who are sitting, you know, at kitchen tables and going over what all this means.
Yeah, it's. I think everyone's kind of scratching their head over this, and because they seem to be fairly, the federal agencies involved seem to be fairly unified in their approach to this, and I think with Paulson coming out and making this announcement, there are several people in government, notably in Congress, who are kind of scratching their heads because the bailout did specifically approve the purchase of these bad securities, the repurchase of these bad securities from banks. So everyone's kind of scrambling to figure out, gee, is this a big change of direction? If it is, why?
Mm-hmm.
Does it mean that the approach wasn't working, or it was too problematic, or they feel this is simply a better use of taxpayer money? And so no one's really entirely sure at this point. And because there's such uncertainty at this point, the market doesn't like that. They like to know pretty much what's going on. And once they think that they don't know what's going on, They tend to head to the sidelines.
Yeah. And today, following the Secretary's remarks and some bad news from the retail front,
right,
the market's down. Although, you know, every time you take a look at it, it's down 39, it's down 300, it's up 200.
Yeah. Well, first of all, it's unprecedented volatility, so it just means these big moves up and down just means that people really don't know what's going on. There's a lot of fear in the market. We've already lost anywhere between, depending on the day and the period you count, but the last 12 months we're down, you know, 39-40%. That qualifies as a, you know, kind of category 4 bear market. It's a good strong one. And normally that's about where you find a bottom, about 40-44% down, in most cases, as bad as it's been since the end of World War II. So people, when it's up, people say, okay, thank goodness, it's all over, and they all jump in, and then something happens, and they get squashed again.
Hmm.
Right now, if you want to measure kind of a way of looking at fear, you can look at the yield on the 3-month Treasury bill, and the more scared people are, the lower it goes. It's kind of an inverse barometer. right now, for 3 months, the government will give you 0.15%, which is pretty close to nothing. Yeah, so fear is pretty high right now.
Yeah. At the moment, I'm not in the market for any credit at the moment, mm-hmm. but where are we in terms of the market, in terms of it being willing to lend money? How tight has credit become, and is that loosening up any at all?
Yeah, credit actually has loosened up a bit. If you look at some of the measures, one of which is the London Interbank Offered Rate, or LIBOR, which is a measure of what banks will lend to each other for, that rate has come down from just ridiculous level. But on the other hand, mortgage rates are still pretty stubbornly high, about 6.5%. So it really hasn't enjoyed much of the interest rate cuts that the Fed has given out. And in general, loans are still hard to come by unless you're very, very creditworthy. I'm just looking up the mortgage rate now. The average rate is 6.2%, according to Freddie Mac, and that's not going to spur any refinancing. It's interesting. I was just in London, where there's great public outcry, where the London Central Bank had, the English Central Bank had cut rates pretty significantly, and banks were reluctant to pass them on to customers, and basically the government told them, you'd better do it. You'd better, lower everybody's mortgage rates, and they did. It would be interesting to see if the federal government did that here.
Mm. I wonder what's on the horizon, and this is just a guessing game here, of course, but mm-hmm. in terms of folks who are struggling to pay mortgages, mm-hmm. You wonder what's on the horizon for these folks. We're seeing discussion of this, debate about it in Washington and in New York City, but what are you hearing? You're the guy on the beat.
Well, there's... there's a couple worries at this point. One of which is that as we've all been focusing on subprime, it's all these people who took out these awful loans, But as the crisis deepens and as the economy slows, it then becomes just regular people who took out mortgages and for one reason or another cannot pay them. So you have people who took out conventional loans where the default rate is very, very low traditionally and still is, who are suddenly becoming troubled. A lot of people take out loans based on two incomes. One person gets fired or laid off. That makes it very difficult. There is a lot of interest, particularly, I think, in the new in the incoming administration to doing a lot of refinancing of these troubled loans. And that would alleviate a lot of stress on individuals, but also it tends to breed some resentment by people who don't get bailed out. At some point, you have to draw a line as to who gets a refinance and who doesn't. And the people who don't, get pretty annoyed.
Hmm. In these times, it's got to be very important to protect your credit rating, your credit score. What should we be doing in that regard?
Sure. Well, there's two things. One of which is do the traditional things that preserve your credit. You pay your bills on time. You pay as much as you can. You keep your debt relatively low. You don't use a lot of debt. The irony of the credit system is that those who don't need it get the best terms. And so that's the traditional route. I guess the one thing that one could say is kind of an opportunity in a perverse sort of way, which is that right now when you're in a market where nothing's working really, commodities aren't working, stocks aren't working, the only thing that's really working right now are treasury bonds, and you get next to nothing for it. So what are you going to do if you have some extra cash, you want to get the biggest bang for your buck, what do you want to do? Well, you have a great opportunity now to pay off your credit cards and any high interest debt you might have. If you pay off a 25% credit card bill, you're earning the equivalent of 25%. You're not going to get that from a mutual fund anytime soon. So that's, you know, just a good way to boost your earnings or to get a nice little pop out of whatever free cash you might have.
One of the issues you take up early in your new book, Bailout, is that of the U.S. debt. What could be the fallout of this economic downturn in terms of U.S. debt?
Well, you know, it's interesting because as long as I've been covering this, and I've been covering it since the late Jurassic period, people have always fretted about the vast amounts of U.S. debt. And in fact, if you you can go to the Treasury Department's webpage, and they'll tell you the debt to the penny, and which I think is somewhere around $10 trillion at this point, which is about $6 trillion. Okay, it's 10.6 trillion. It is a staggering sum of money. It is, let's see, our GDP is about 14. trillion, so it's getting, you know, it's getting pretty high. If you had that level of debt to your income, you'd be concerned. And what is most problematic about it is that every week we have to raise $20 or so billion just to keep the thing going. You know, that's new interest, new debt, and of that we have to borrow about $10 billion from foreigners because we don't have enough savings in our country to invest that amount every month. So every week, $10 billion comes up for sale that we have to sell to somebody else. And of late, we have been selling quite a bit to the Chinese, quite a bit to OPEC countries, quite a bit to Japan, some to England. But what would be very unfortunate is if one day these kind foreigners who are financing our debt said, you know, we don't really need $10 billion of T-bills yielding 0.15% anymore. We just don't think that's a very attractive return. We're only going to buy $8 billion. If that happens, then rates would have to rise to attract more investors, and it means that rates would rise into a recession, which would be you know, a very unpleasant thing indeed. And it also limits the ability of, you know, the incoming administration or any future Congresses to finance other things. For example, if, God forbid, we got into another war, you're going to have to get the money from somewhere. And, you know, it might be a lot tougher to get money from foreign investors.
Yeah. As individuals and as families, it's possible to understand when we're in too deep. But when it comes to the U.S. and the world, how much debt is too much?
Well, that's the $10 trillion question. you know, people have been saying for a long time, it's too much, it's too much, it's all going to come home to roost. But on the other hand, you know, we have a big, wealthy country with a great, big, unbeatable army, and you know, that makes us a very attractive place, particularly in times of turmoil. Okay, people now they used to buy gold when you know the world seemed like it was falling apart, and now they buy treasury bills because that's where they feel their money is the safest. They don't care if they don't get any decent rate of return; they just get their money back. That's all they want. You know? But at some point, what's the tipping point? Is it 11 trillion? There's a kind of a weird landmark, which is that. There used to be something called the debt clock in Times Square, which would, you know, turn over with some frightening rate at the amount we owed, and they had to take it down recently because there were too many digits. They ran out of places for the debt. So at some point, and it's that famous line from, I think, The Sun Also Rises, when someone says, you know, how did you go broke? And the other person says, well, two ways, slowly and then suddenly. There's always that point where everybody goes, oh, no, and things can happen very, very quickly. It may take a long time to lead up to it, but when it happens fast.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, journalist John Wagner. He's an investment columnist and personal finance reporter for USA Today. He's the author most recently of Bailout, What the Rescue of Bear Stearns and the Credit Crisis Mean for Your investments. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's take a call now from a listener in Champaign, waiting on line one. Hi.
Comment on critics who say the credit default swap should be set aside or canceled. And why was Lehman allowed to go under when now everyone else seems to be getting something?
Well, so your question really is why was Lehman allowed to fail when everybody else seems to be getting AIG and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and real seems to be getting bailed out? Well, that's a good question. I have a feeling that the people who made that decision felt that, gee, you have to draw a line and stand somewhere. You know, you can't. There has to be some market discipline. And, you know, there's a wonderful quote, and I'm not sure who I'm stealing this from, but just as there are no atheists in foxholes, there are no free marketers in bankruptcy court. And while it's all well and good to say, you know, you have to let the market show some discipline and let these institutions fail, the consequences of having them fail are pretty profound. And I think what they were trying to do was to kind of slap the financial services industry a little bit and say, hey, you guys better shape up, because if you're not careful, what happened to Lehman is going to happen to you. And unfortunately, when Lehman went down, created a whole host of other problems.
It's a question. The caller want a follow-up? No, the caller is rung off. Okay. Well, what's on the horizon? The automakers are now in line. What do you think?
Well, you know, what's it, the old camel's nose in the tent, which is, you know, if you bail out the financial services industry, shouldn't you bail out the automakers? And there is historical precedent for at least giving federal aid to the automakers, the famous Chrysler bailout. And to their credit, you know, they return the money with interest. So, and also, for just another bit to ponder over, is I think they're asking somewhere between $25 and $50 billion, which, you know, is chump change to what we've spent on the financial services industry. They're big employers. They keep a lot of people working. It's a very important part of the economy. So you make a very good argument for bailing them out. The question is that, you know, at what point, you know, do you draw the line? You know, if the neighborhood drugstore industry goes down, does that mean you should bail out all those folks? This is the whole question of it. At what point are businesses held responsible for their misjudgment?
Other questions, comments from listeners are invited this afternoon for our guest, John Wagner. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Listener in Champaign on line one. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
I wonder what the guest might say about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac having lobbyists and giving to political PACs, if you will, and doing all kinds of advertising, paying their executives outrageous bonuses. We had this story in the news a few weeks ago about them doing the spa thing out in California, et cetera. You know, who is this congressional agencies not doing any oversight, or what? I mean, how did they get along? How did they get away with this for so long?
Yeah, you know, that's a good question. The Freddie and Fannie, you know, actually originally were designed. Fannie anyway was designed fully as a federal agency, and sometime in the 70s they decided to make it a quasi-public agency. And I don't think making anything quasi-public is that good of an idea, frankly. There are too many different masters to be served. I honestly think that it was a mistake to do that. And I am sure there will be inevitably the, you know, the public hearings and whatnot that will point fingers. But, yeah, it's tough. You know, as a taxpayer, you say, well, gee, here are these guys who drove actually good, productive companies into the ground, and they're getting paid millions of dollars for that. And, you know, heck, I would have destroyed the company for, $2 million, So I think it's a fair question to ask. I personally think that probably it's either better totally as a private company or totally as a federal agency, but this kind of half and half just doesn't seem to be working.
Okay.
Well, I mean, that game seemed to be somewhat fixed, if you will, and again, nobody was watching the rules, if you will. Can I make a comment about the car industry?
Sure.
I've been one of those that for the last 30-plus years, I've driven foreign cars because, A, I felt they were better made, B, better economy, and C, the ones I've chosen to drive, safer vehicles. To me, Ford and GM have now, just in the last few years, come up with product that is maybe comparable, but in years past, in all the decades past, they made terrible product. And I hate to see people lose their jobs. I hate to really see auto workers lose their jobs. But why should an auto industry who has not responded to consumer interest and consumer demand, really, because they went to the marketplace and bought other products like I did, why should we bail them out?
Well, this comes down to just this interesting policy thing where if you feel the market should determine, what companies live and what companies die, and many people do, and it's a reasonable argument, then you should say, well, in any company has the potential to go bankrupt, and that includes GM, which I think is selling for under $4 a share. Ford, which is selling under $2 a share at this point. And so you have to ask yourself, well, can we do that? It's pretty harsh. You're letting a lot of people out of work for a long time. The sad part is I love U.S. cars. U.S. cars are great these days. I think they've done a really good job of building cars in the last decade. You have to wrap them a little bit for being short-sighted about the SUV craze. But by and large, U.S. cars are really pretty good. Now, unfortunately, they have really good cars, and they're in the middle of this dreadful recession. And even good cars are pretty tough to sell in a market like this.
I want to thank the listener for his call. Let's go to another listener now in Urbana on line 2. Hi.
Hi. Can you take a personal finance question?
Sure.
I recently retired, actually, the end of September, and I'm waiting to get my retirement payout for unused sick leave and vacation and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to have a chunk of money, which I had planned to put into my traditional IRA and part into my deferred compensation.
Okay.
In lieu of the market issue right now, are these still good moves to make, or what's your opinion? And I'll hang up and listen on air. Thank you.
Sure. Well, it depends on what your investment options are. And the first thing I always tell people when they get these big chunks of money is that you don't have to do anything right away. If you decide you're going to take that money and park it in a CD or in the money fund option in your 401k or your retirement plan, that's fine. The world is not going to end, and you're not going to be horribly broke because you took 6 months and said, I'm just going to kind of deal with this calmly and see what I think about it. Now the difficult part is that sooner or later you will have to make a decision. You can go in a couple of different ways. One thing I tell people is there are some big mutual fund companies, T. Rowe Price, Vanguard, Fidelity, that will give you, pretty straightforward advice on how you should invest your money, given your age and your goals and when you're going to need things. And try that. It's very low cost. If not, you can try talking to a fee-only financial planner, the person who takes not a commission, but rather charges you on an hourly or a flat fee basis. And that's a good thing because they don't really have as much of an axe to grind as to what they recommend. and take some time and just talk it out with them. Generally speaking, people who divide their assets about 50-50 between stocks and bonds at retirement age, and they withdraw about 4% to 5% a year of their initial total, do just fine. You know, and it's a pretty simple allocation. So I would say take some time, think about it. No shame in waiting for the dust to settle. You're not going to miss, you know, everything if you don't invest today. And go and get a couple extra opinions and see what you feel. You'll probably wind up with about a 50-50 split between stocks and bonds, and that's a perfectly reasonable thing. Stocks and bonds tend to move in opposite directions, and you'll do okay with that.
Okay. Good luck to the listener. Let's take another call now, a listener on line 4 in Will County. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
Maybe you can give me some news on some of the plans that are being floated with respect to foreclosures. In particular, there's an economist who wrote in New York Times, whose name I forgot, is an example of someone who feels that folks who are upside down on their mortgages shouldn't necessarily be made whole, or they shouldn't get out with some equity position. His plan, the mechanics of it were, in short, the banks would do a workout down to a payment they could afford, but the banks would have a right on the future increase in equity in the home. So that essentially, in shorthand, the owner who's upside down would have the privilege of staying in his home, but he'd have the status of a renter for 5 years. And then the equity recouped over that period of time would actually go back to the bank, not to the homeowner. Mm-hmm. That's one example of a plan where the consequences of making a bad mortgage are not removed from the homeowner. The question I have is, do you know the status mm-hmm. or legs that a plan like that has? Is that Sheila Bair's plan? Is anybody with some status, anybody with some traction, have a plan, something like this nature?
Yeah, I've heard that one, and I'm trying to remember who precisely has put that forward. That might be Sheila Bair. And there's a lot of different ways. During the Depression, for example, the government refinanced thousands of mortgages, and they actually wound up making a profit on the deal after many years. But still, you know, taxpayers got their money back. I think what they have to balance here, and it's important, is that in all these things, it's taxpayers' money, and they should make some effort to recoup it as much as possible. So you can inject capital into a bank. Okay, fine. And capital is the money that banks use to cushion against losses. And that's fine, but the government and taxpayers should get a return on it. They should get equity stakes in the bank, and they should get actually even a guaranteed rate. I think in England they're demanding 12%. And that's a steep penalty, but on the other hand, they're being bailed out for bad business decisions, and they need to pay that penalty. So I think we're going to see really in the next couple months a lot of these plans batted around for bailing out homeowners. I don't know where we're going to land. Clearly, it seems to me that this administration is kind of saying, you know, we're almost done here. It's up to the next group, and the next group has only been, you know, really thinking seriously about this for, you know, a month or two at the most.
Does the caller want to follow up?
No. I think I'm standing by watching just like you are.
Yeah.
And hoping that we can correct the systemic problems, but not pretend that in every individual case is going to be made nice again, you know?
Yeah, and you know, you're right, and that's exactly the problem, which is that at some point you have to draw the line saying, okay, you over here, Fred, are going to get bailed out, and you over here, George, are not, and you can bet dollars to donuts that, you know, George is going to be pretty upset, and any solution is not going to be pretty.
Mm-hmm. Let's take another call now, a listener in Urbana on line 3. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
A couple of callers ago was talking about the automobile industry and the bailout and all those people losing their jobs. Mm-hmm. What I want to know is, are those CEOs and people who are making the millions and gazillion dollar salaries willing to, that are the CEOs of the automobile companies, are they willing to give up some of their huge salaries to help save this, these companies? I mean, it seems to me all the people who are making $30,000, $50,000 a year, the ones that are going to be out of an income, but these rich people are going to keep their big salaries.
Well, I think you know, you really have to. There is a problem in this country with CEO salaries, and in particular, this comes from boards of directors who say, "Oh, yeah, Fred, you know you." You know, you deserve $12 million a year, even though the stock has fallen 50%. Well, that kind of performance would get the average guy fired. And there's no reason to create this kind of aristocracy that's held up by, you know, kind of boards of directors that are in the pockets of these guys.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope this becomes something that becomes an issue. But particularly for companies, when we've talked about a couple, you know, AIG is one, Freddie Mac, Fannie Mae, all these fellows who have run once fine companies into the ground should not be rewarded with
rich. Yeah, they've gotten off with hundreds of millions of dollars.
Right, right. And, I hear people say, well, you know, they should have their packages taken away from them and stuff like that. I don't know what the legal process for that would be, but I just know that As a taxpayer, you know, I'm not even getting free checking out of the deal. I'd kind of like to make sure that those guys don't get anything either.
Yeah. Well, that's just been a question on my mind is, you know, what are those high-paid salaried people going to do to help for the bailout?
Well, you know, the argument always is, well, we'll never be able to attract talent if we just offer them, you know, $5 million. And I'm going, well, you know, I know a lot of people who pretty good, you know, might be able to do a decent job for $5 million. But
yeah,
I don't know. I think it's one of those arguments that we're going to see examined a great deal.
Yeah, well, I haven't heard anybody mention it. So, well, thank you.
Sure, thank you.
Thanks for the call. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, personal finance reporter for USA Today and columnist John Wagner. His latest book is Bailout, What the Rescue of Bear Stearns and the Credit Crisis Means for Your Investments. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, and toll-free 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Consumer confidence appears, to put it mildly, pretty shaky at the moment. Do you think we'll see a turn toward saving more and spending less? And what would that mean here in the short term for the economy now in recession, apparently?
Well, you know, it's interesting because the last time I looked at consumer confidence, which was a week or so ago, I believe it was at the lowest since 1973, 74, which was another the harshest recession since the Great Depression. And because I had been around since the Jurassic period, I remember 1973 and 1974. And, you know, this is not 1973, 1974. Back then, you know, you had gas lines, you had 12% mortgage rates, you had 10% unemployment. Things are really dreadful. Right now, the confidence level is at an all-time low. It has never been lower than this. So that even, you know, way back when all those dreadful things were happening, people were a bit more cheerful. I don't know whether that's just because people are very fearful of losing their jobs, and that's certainly true. But the question you raise is very interesting, which is that, yes, when people are worried, what they do is they spend less and they save more, and this is a fairly famous economic thing called the paradox of thrift, which is when everybody does that and you don't spend, then the economy contracts further. And what the government and regulators have to do is try to get people feeling confident enough that they'll have their jobs in a year, and that means that they'll be able to spend, you know, buy a car or, you know, put a deck on the house or something like that. And it's hard, and it's particularly hard because consumer, just like the government, is also pretty tapped out. They're spending a lot of money paying on debt. Now, if in 2 years everybody has paid down their credit cards and, you know, kind of paid down their home equity lines and that frees up some cash, that's good. It just means that there'll be a sluggish period in the meantime while everybody deleverages and pays down their debt and gets back to a, you know, a sensible financial footing.
Hmm. Let's take another call. A listener in Savoy, line one. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
I was kind of wondering what the guest thought about whether or not we should have put this hundreds of billions of dollars that we're using for the bailout into a program for universal health care instead, because obviously if we're paying for health care for everybody, all these gigantic companies with hundreds of thousands of employees would no longer be paying those costs for health care, and it would free up that money for them to use that we are in essence giving them, and all that money is most likely going to be going to the CEOs and not the individuals that are needing the money the most.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting question. Anytime the public is asked to put out a large sum of money, and by any measure, $700 billion is just a ton of money, the question always should arise, well, could we have spent this better? I think what we're doing now is propping up the financial system, and I think that's very important. I think it's a good expenditure. But you do raise an interesting question, which is a little bit off to the side, which is that I've never understood why a company like General Motors, for example, or any big American country is not thumping the table for universal health care, partly because when General Motors goes up against Toyota or goes up against Daimler-Benz, these are companies that do not have to worry about that. That's not built into the cost of their products, and it's a distinct competitive disadvantage for big companies. I could be wrong. It could be that GM and Ford have been pounding on the government for years for this, but I've never heard it. It just seems like it would make sense for them. It would be in their enlightened self-interest to push for government health care. Now, this is entirely besides the question of whether government health care is good or bad, but it just seems that it would be in their interest. If I'm wrong, I'd be curious to hear your opposing argument.
You want to follow up?
Sure. I also think that it would be more effective on the grand scale, because it would also give those people who are paying money for health insurance or health care costs in general more money to put back into the economy. And it's just interesting to me that none of the political higher-ups have never brought out this type of argument, especially Obama, who supports a universal health care program, but is still pushing for the bailout as well, which seems kind of contradictory to me.
Right. Well, I mean, the one thing is that they would have to raise taxes in some way to pay for universal health care, most likely. So it's not like your insurance premiums would just vanish. You'd be paying another hand somewhere. Now, I don't know. I mean, there are people. We have one of those plans where you can put away money for all the stuff that your deductibles, don't cover. And I know I put away $3,000 a year, and I know that we're usually done with that by September. So, I could use that money. I just don't know at this point. Not really informed enough to make a really good comment is whether I would be actually saving money from a government health care program or not. But anything that can get money into people's pockets is all too good. That's why they were just basically handing out free money earlier in the year, giving everybody $600, saying just go out, spend, be happy. They may well do that again.
Yeah, although as I have been, let me see if I have it here, of all that money that went out into the mail, we spent $12 billion of $78 billion.
Right.
So that wasn't exactly real productive, although if folks paid down debt, you know, that's a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, and again, that's what, you know, if someone came to me and they had $10,000 in credit card debt and they say, gee, I have the $600 check, what should I do with it? The first thing I tell them is pay off your debt. What's the matter with you? And that's a perfectly, you know, people did exactly the right thing with it. Unfortunately, the right thing wasn't what the government wanted people to do, particularly.
Yeah. Over and over in this conversation, John, we've come back to credit, credit, credit. Mm-hmm. That seems to me to be the key. We had, it seems to me, easy credit got the flames going.
Right.
And now we don't have any credit.
Well, that's right. And what I argue in my book is that all the problems in the stock market are really just a symptom of something we haven't seen in quite a long time, which is a bear market in debt. And a bear market in debt is substantially different from a bear market in stocks, which is that we can all kind of get along if our stocks fall. But when you can't get credit and there are no loans and it has a much harsher effect on the economy. It really pretty much grinds the economy to a halt when companies can't get loans or towns and municipalities can't borrow money in the credit markets. That is profoundly different and also, I think, much harsher than any meltdown in the stock market. And what we're seeing now is something we really haven't seen in many, many years, which is just a massive crumbling of the debt market. And it's never pretty. It takes a long time to work out. And at the end, we'll all be better for it, but it's not much fun in the meantime.
Yeah. Well, it seems to me that, as I understand it, easy credit played a role in inflating the bubble of the housing market. And,
Absolutely, and that was the thing. If you go, well, you know, I hear people say, well, these people are so stupid to take out loans that they couldn't afford. And absolutely, you know, people should be responsible for their financial decisions. But banks were even stupider to lend their money to people who couldn't afford it. Unfortunately, the problem was that the loans were often being made by mortgage brokers who didn't really care whether someone could repay it. They just got paid as they made the loan. And the banks sold off their loans to Wall Street, who then sold them off to everybody else. So nobody had any real skin in the game. Nobody cared whether the loans got repaid until suddenly they didn't. And that's when it became a problem. There was nobody had any real skin in the game until the whole thing fell apart.
And now we won't know more about derivatives than we ever wanted to.
Oh, you know, who ever thought you'd be sitting around talking with friends about derivatives? What a world.
We have one last caller hanging on, and I'll have to ask both of you to be brief. Listener on line 4, Spring Bay, we only have about a minute and a half left.
Good program. I just wanted to make a comment and get your response to it. Salaries, wages in line with housing. And, you know, house prices have either got to drop to get down to an affordable level for wages, or wages will have to go up to support it. And so, interesting show, and I'll hang up and listen to the rest.
Thanks. Okay, interesting comment question.
Oh, well, you're right. Everybody, if everybody got a 10% raise, you know, life would be better. You know, right up there. And that is, you know, that is one solution. But what happened was people didn't take into account salaries and the amount of loans. And so he's got a point. You know, at this point, with housing down vastly from where it was, you're finally beginning to see, you know, some good deals in housing. You're starting to see some affordable housing. That's great if you've got some money and decent credit. You know, you can do all right.
Yeah.
So, you know, I hope eventually, you know, maybe everybody will get raises and prices will be reasonable and we'll all get back to where we'd like to be. And I guess really the answer is let's keep our fingers crossed and hope that it doesn't get worse.
Yeah, and I think also here, for those of us who are living through this now, I think we might think about our homes as assets in a much more conservative manner.
That's right.
Over the next
few
years.
Good place to live in, nice if you make money when you move out, but not really the place to bet the farm on.
Yeah. John, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Oh, thank you. I really enjoyed it.
John Wagoner covers the personal finance beat for USA Today. He is one of the authors of the NOLO Guide, the Busy Family's Guide to Money. His latest book, Bailout, What the Rescue of Bear Stearns and the Credit Crisis Mean for Your Investments, is published by Wiley.